For me, adopting a belief system, I need to choose a worldview. I need to make sure that this worldview falls in line with what it is that I am doing on this earth. A worldview means I understand where I came from, what is my purpose in this world, where I will be going. It's to have a good direction. It's to understand what life is. It's to make sure that I realize my responsibility and get to the goals and objectives that I have. And it all rotates around creation and trying to get a grasp onto why I am living. Me being created by the divine entity, by God Almighty. When I understand that through Tawheed, through monotheism, through inspiration from the likes of such great personalities like the Holy Prophets and the Imams, that worldview will be so strong and firm, it will keep me on that right path that I wish to be on. If I make sure that I am accountable and responsible for absolutely everything that I do, I will be loyal and committed to the meaning of this life. I'll make sure that I don't harm others. I'll make sure that I'm always good and nice and kind. Why? Because I know that there is a judgment day that will be coming. That's a part of my worldview, accountability. That's the first thing that is very, very important for me to understand and implement in my practical life. Being responsible and being accountable. Know that there is a hisab and a kitab that will be waiting for me once I depart this very short life of mine. Number two is to guide myself and to guide others. Be a lantern of guidance and guide yourself and guide others towards these sacred objectives and goals to live a meaningful life. And number three, to make sure that we are vibrant and active and positive and lay down very good, productive precedents that will be used not only for us in this lifestyle, in this world that we live in, but also for future generations, for those who are after us. Leave a good legacy behind us. That is what my religion teaches me. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin. Ilahana ma'ada lak malika kun liman malak labbayka qad labbaytu lak. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. سبحانه أعظم والملك لا شريك له لبيك إن الحمد لك والعز لا شريك له. Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio with a smiling face, we have Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So we've entered into a new phase of media censorship. The Western media has a long track record of actually censoring the voice of the revolution, the voice of Iran, the voice of the Islamic Republic, the voice of people anywhere, everywhere, who speak out against the system anyway. But now we've actually entered a phase where they've seized the websites of Press TV and Al-Masira and Al-Alam and other such channels out there. Now, this is a little bit strange. This actually shows us that the enemy is more on edge, it seems, than ever was before. The election of Sayyid Raisi may have a big part to play in this. I'd like to get your opening thoughts on this entire thing. I think Sheikh Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is nothing new, like you pointed out in your opening statement. When we look at the track record of the Western hegemonic governments and their affiliated apparatus, right? Even, you know, I would go to a point where United Nations and other so-called international organizations, they're part of that whole strategy and that whole plan. They have been silencing the word of logic, the word of rationality, the word of tolerance, the word of exposing the evil and standing up and resisting against the evil. Mm-hmm. This is nothing new. It has been going on throughout the history, even before this electronic media existed, right? If you look at the history, back in the day too, they would silence people from talking about and bringing up the realities of this world, right? Mm-hmm. So this is nothing new. Now, why is it happening now? Again, like you pointed out, I think the enemy, you know, they've realized that they're losing on the propagation and propaganda field as well. For instance, one of the examples, just to elaborate on this point, you look at the anti-Israel sentiment in the entire world. Right, especially the Western countries, right, where they praised back in the day, they praised the Zionist regime, and you know, in the name of human rights and so on and so forth, and rights for Jewish people and so on and so forth. Now, if you go and talk to those people, because I've been in touch, right, 10, 15 years ago, the anti-Israel sentiment was very insignificant 15 years ago.
And it was limited to kind of clusters of activist groups,
exactly.
And Muslims,
exactly.
Some Muslims.
And non-Muslims too. It was very, very contained, right? It was not the mainstream narrative. Now, fast-forwarding, especially after the social media and, you know, the officers of the software that are out there, the way they have raised the information level and the facts that they have presented and the logical discourses that they have presented, it has compelled many people out there, especially in the West. I keep saying West because I know in America, you know, when I used to read anytime there's a news report about Palestine or Israel in one of the mainstream news outlets, I used to read comments. You know, I think you all do every once in a while, you know, just to see what's going on, how are people. Well, back in the day, 15 years ago maybe, you would hardly find maybe one or two people exposing the crimes of the Zionist regime, right? Most of the people, they were, like I pointed out, they were supportive in one way or the other. But now if you go on any of these news, now the news channels have to delete those comments.
Yeah, often they'll say comments are not allowed.
Right? Why are they doing it? Because they're losing on that battlefield as well, and it has changed the perception of the people of the world, the general masses of the world.
I'm going to want to come back to this, but Sayyid Mahdi, so Sheikh Ali pointed out how previously, if you go 10, 15 years back, the negative sentiments towards Israel were lower than they are today. And we talked about how the activists and those small clusters of groups that existed back then who were pro-Palestine, they were contained back then, and now it's not so contained. Now, my question to you is, these groups obviously did a lot of propagation, they did lots of work, they created posters, they held up banners, they went to the protests, and all those kinds of things. To what extent do you feel that they have had an impact on the wider audiences out there?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's a very good point. It's a very solid point that even a small group of people, if they are dedicated, if they remain steadfast, if they believe in their cause and their cause is a just cause, it might take a little bit of time, but surely they will overcome and they will be victorious even upon a larger host. Taking it from a very general, you know, in my own words perspective, which I put forth, but if you look at the Holy Quran, it says the same thing, right? That how many a small host has overcome a very large host, and what is the differentiating factor? It's not weapons and power and money and these kind of things. It's remaining steadfast, remaining on the correct path, being patient in the adversity, continuing to move forward, and fighting for a just cause. These small groups, you know, back in the day, were fighting a huge propaganda machinery, which was being pushed by the Zionist powers and pro-Zionist lobbies. I mean, even today, these Zionist lobbies are humongous. And the fact that they're losing this propaganda war or this war of information is really, I think, one, humiliating for them, despite
all those resources that they have at their disposal.
I mean, yeah, the resources, the amount of global leaders that are in their pockets, you know.
The government supporting them.
The central banks that these people.
The intimidation, let's not forget that as well. The intimidation, the police forces are on their side. The system is actually on their side, and yet.
And despite all this, you find that this small group of people who were standing up for the just cause of Palestine, and the cause of Palestine itself is just, just go and read the history about it. They stood up, they stayed steadfast, and you have seen that the tide has turned. And now, more so than in solidarity of the Zionist state, the world is now in solidarity with the people of Palestine.
So coming back to Sheikh Ali, this idea of them having lost, essentially, the soft war, at least the previous battles, they've lost them. Are we saying that that's the main factor and cause in why they are censoring these predominantly Shia media
course,
outlets?
Of course, if you look at the enemy, they don't want the masses to, you know, wake up, right? That's one of the agendas of the mainstream media, to keep them in slumber, keep them sleeping, you know, just be irrelevant in this whole equation of, you know, truth versus falsehood and righteousness versus falsehood, the haq and batil. They want them to be just indifferent, right? Just focus on your own life, because it goes with their whole philosophy of life and the outlook they have towards the world and the life, where they say that you're a social animal who should only be concerned with your own needs and wants. You know, just stay there, and no need. While when you look at Islam, for instance, or even human logic, right? We cannot be indifferent about a person dying on the street. Mm. We cannot be indifferent about, you know, a pregnant woman not reaching the hospital. We cannot be indifferent about a neighbor who is suffering, right?
It's this just is the true human definition of a social life.
Right.
Their definition is a contradiction, as you
right.
said.
So what these media outlets, you know, especially the ones who are banned, I don't know about all of them because I haven't really studied all of them, but at least a few I know of, which were news reporting websites and satellite channels, they are banned because due to their activities and because what they were putting out there and they were informing people, the masses were waking up. Mm-hmm. Waking up against oppression, waking up against tyranny, waking up against this control that the Western hegemonic governments have had over them for decades, mm-hmm. if not centuries, right? They were waking up to the reality of so-called liberal democracy, you know, the last 200 years phenomena, you know, it's just like a hoax, you know, where people were made to believe that you have a say, you have a right, you have... No, you don't have right, you don't have say, you don't have freedom of expression, you don't have freedom of speech in the West. You look at the academics who were not even Muslims, right? In some cases, they were Jewish people, right? These academics, their careers were ruined because they exposed the Western treachery and their plots, and especially the evil nature of the Zionist regime of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. Their academic careers were destroyed. Well, he's a teacher, he's a professor, right? Norman Finkelstein, for instance, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. So on and so forth. There are too many of them, right? It's just one example.
And even people who weren't associated with the idea of Palestine, so to speak, but people like Julian Assange, who were just pointing out that, look, the flaws of the Western imperialistic system, right. even they're imprisoned.
Right. Now they're feeling vulnerable. Now the West is feeling vulnerable. They've put together something over the course of last 200 years, which is called the liberal democracy and its affiliated apparatus. They're feeling that it's vulnerable. People are not going to get tricked into and take it as at its face value. People are standing up, challenging that system, right? You saw, like, even with the so-called democracy, how people opposed the elected government and the Trump era and the transition to Biden. You saw that, right?
Fiasco. The storming of the Capitol is a huge historical event.
Right. So now they're seeing that we are weak. They're seeing that the masses are waking up. They're seeing that it is not that we can just put out a multi-million dollar news reporting website or a TV channel or a satellite channel and the masses will be fooled that easily.
Or even that the movies that they make are going to completely, put out their propaganda. Exactly. You know, you have superhero movies exactly. presenting the American military right. as the right. good guys and stuff. Right. So
now
people are even waking up to the cracks
in
that.
Now, the question is, connecting it back to your question, with all this in mind, who made it all happen? How did the masses wake up? It is because of projects like Press TV. It is because of projects like Al-Aram. It is because of projects like Al-Masira, right? These are the projects which are run by human beings, not by robots. Like, their setups are being run by, you know, the machine-built artificial intelligence-based censorship and all that. No, mm-hmm. these are human beings who are interacting with other people. And when that sentiment gets put out there in form of news, it has an effect on people. And because they were being effective in exposing the plots of the tyrants and the oppressive governments, they are silenced. Because that's all the West can do. They just know how to silence others, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes countries, sometimes governments, sometimes media channels, sometimes... Look at the crackdown that happened on social media profiles right after the martyrdom of Shahid Qasem Soleimani, mm-hmm. right? People who had established profiles, 10 years, 12 years old profiles, they were wiped off their platforms.
Yes.
From Facebook, from Twitter, from YouTube, from Instagram, you know, so on and so forth. Now what we're seeing, this recent wave, is targeting those channels which are on satellite. So when it comes to social media, many of these channels of spreading the truth, they were removed. Now it's the turn of the satellite channels, Press TV and Al-Masira and Al-Alam and all that.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parsetoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today. Yeah, Allah.
Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
Old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just to, so my nana can rest and I can rest and me and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, yeah, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They should work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums, and their swags and everything used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shirings.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed. How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
I told the doctor.
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife, Marion, has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from. And I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had, like, constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than it used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20-litre drums. The stuff in the 20-litre drums was like engine oil or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
Getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and now I'm more confined to a wheelchair. Put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this. And it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a band-aid on it. And I just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself. It's hard.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and, I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities?
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners. Welcome to another program of Islamic Upbringing here at IRIB English Radio. We talk about problems that we face in these societies that we live in regards to our children and their upbringing, and we try to shed light upon them through the Quran and the Ahadith and the tradition of our Holy Prophet and A'imma alayhi salatu wassalam, our Imams. Today in our studio, we've got Brother Abdullah Al-Musawi with us to help us figure out some problems and their solutions that we face as parents in our society. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to another program of Islamic Upbringing.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Brother, if you do remember our previous program, we talked about protection that we need to give our children, physical and psychological, mental, ideological. We touched upon TV, right? And we did talk a lot of matter in regards to TV and things that we face in this society. But this is a very deep ocean, isn't it? And screen time, you know, generally parents are busy with their chores, or even if they're not, they've come back from work, they're tired, they want to rest, and they just hand over the tablet, the TV, whatever it is, to children, and there you are, and expose your child is to the world of unlimited possibilities, right? How do we tackle the dangers that these possibilities bring with them?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. We always say that before you treat something, you need to understand the problem itself.
Yeah,
understanding, identifying the problem is half the solution. That a lot of people and a lot of parents don't understand the dangers of TV and movies and you know social media and all these things. So parents really need to sit first, educate themselves in these dangers, get to know what's going on, because sometimes this is sadly also happening. That I can't remember, I was just talking to somebody about something, and he said, "Oh, this is like, you know, a 5 a.m. theory, conspiracies." I'm like, "This is not conspiracies," because sometimes, like, when you talk to parents, that there are people at play trying to manipulate your child, brainwash your child. It's like, you know, you're just taking it too far. You just being a conspiracy theorist, right? You just lost your mind. Well, no, you need to wake up. You need to, like we say, wake up and smell the coffee. That's life. So you need to educate yourself first and foremost of what's going on, what's happening. That's the basic of everything. Two, you need, for example, before you put a device in your child's hand. It needs to be monitored. It needs to be maintained. It needs to be supervised. Because once you throw it to his hand, then like a couple of years back, when you see a child becomes addicted and you're trying to take away from him, good luck. Let's see how that works out.
Yeah.
So it needs to be what? There has to be a monitoring system. So educate yourself. Have that monitoring system. Three, that before you let a child watch a movie, for example, you watch it yourself.
Yeah.
Dissect that movie. See what message that movie's trying to give.
Yeah.
Because, for example, as innocent as Tom and Jerry, right? I read the statistics. I think they said in each episode there's at least like over 30, 40 times a death scene where, for example, Jerry gets killed by Tom. So every time he drops something on him, that's a death. Every time he skins him alive, that's a death. So is as innocent as that might be, but they're teaching a child violence. And they're switching the picture as well. Usually cats are domestic pets and they're cute and they don't harm. They, you know, and the mouse, you know, it's a mouse. But they make the cat as the evil creature. And the mouse that doesn't even has an existence is the one that's a hero, and he's the one that's always standing for his right. So the
subliminal messages is what we talking about within movies and within cartoons, and the suggestion and the advice that you have is actually very interesting and should come to us naturally, but we haven't done that, is to watch it ourselves first. We'll carry on about this topic after this very short break. Please stay tuned.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
Welcome back to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about media, specifically movies and TV generally. And might be other devices also, but movies, cartoons, and how we leave our children exposed. I remember, do you remember this series, Frozen? I've also realized that also had an LGBT agenda to it.
It is nothing but LGBT agenda.
That's insane.
Yeah, and not just, it had actually even, some people might think I'm just losing my mind, even incest. The relationship between Elsa and her sister Anna, it wasn't an innocent relationship, right? If you dissect the movie to its core, analyze it, it had that kind of sense to it. And then you had that changing between, you know, moving from one guy to another and so on and so forth. So it's loaded, but with kids, it's entertaining. And the song is very catchy itself, Let It Go.
That is so evil.
Right? Which means what? Which means like whatever you go through in life, just let it go.
Yeah, that's Nike.
Just move on. Just you have a problem with your parents? Move on. Just let them and move. You know, it's like, what are you trying to teach the child? Through just let it go. And I've seen so many kids just sing that song. Let it go, let it go.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's so catchy.
It's very catchy. These guys, they sit there for years and years. They're trying to come up with an attractive song. They're trying to come up with themes. They're trying to come up with colors. They don't spend millions of dollars just so they entertain you or your child.
For people who say it's a conspiracy theory, like, do you really think that people just sit in there and... the first thing that that comes to their mind, they're like, all right, let's go with it. No, they actually plan it out.
They plan
it
to the detail, huh? I was watching a movie recently. We were doing an interview about it. And the few times the camera zooms on the door's number, the house number, sorry.
Right.
All right.
In
so
the movie.
In the movie. So all a few times the number caught my attention of the house. Why do they always... keep
focus
bringing it.
That, yeah.
So the movie itself, in its realm, it was a religious movie, so it was a Christian religious movie. I took that number, I tapped it on Google, which is this like two numbers, which is a verse from the Bible, which was actually talking about a person that will come from the desert and the next to the sea, and he's evil, and you do the rest.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, that is
so two numbers, like two digits. Plus the digits, because it was a four-digit number. It had a meaning that a lot of people don't understand. So it was a verse, a quote from the Bible, which directly talks about that whoever comes from the Middle East or claims to be a prophet is an evil man.
Yeah.
So don't think...
And the Middle East in general has been portrayed
as the devil's cradle. They take their time in studying every single aspect that comes to the movie and what you're going to watch. So you need to educate yourself on what's been watched. Before, and I'm not sure if we have enough time.
It is actually time for a break. So before we move into the next conversation, we'll just go for a short break. Please stay tuned. And we'll be back shortly.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the subliminal problems that we face in terms of our children's upbringing and media, TV, movies, cartoons. Yeah, so the Middle East, we were talking about how it's been portrayed as the most evil thing that has ever existed. And everyone who comes out of the Middle East is just something that you need to save yourself from.
Mm-hmm. So what we said, we tried to go to the next point after that, is that when your kids watch... All right, and you watch with them. I always watch with my kids.
And you also watch before?
Before.
Yeah,
so I make sure the movie is okay. I download it on the hard drive. I don't just give them a remote to, an open, services like Netflix and them. No, I watch it, make sure it's okay. I put it on a hard drive, then you can watch. I sit with watch with them. Sometimes there are things you cannot avoid, obviously, because otherwise you're not going to watch any movie.
Yeah.
What I do is I highlight to them the mistakes and the evil plans.
Right, you tell them, look, that's not right.
I tell them, this is not right. They're trying to do this, they're trying to do that. And now my kids are aware of these plots, and now they themselves identify
them. So they're skeptical about the movie itself right before.
So now they themselves identify, okay, this is wrong. So they become aware through you teaching them. So you're not saying, no, you're not going to watch movies, you're not going to watch cartoons. Obviously, that has a negative impact. But go through the process, watch with them, explain to them what's going on, right? And I always, like, every time me and my friends, when we go to the movies, every time we watch a movie, we finish watching a movie, we come outside, once we come out of the theater, we talk about this movie. Like, not what happened as an event. What message was they trying to push? What's the agenda before it, after it, and so on and so on. Like, we watched some of Marvel movies, like Endgame and all these. And these were loaded with messages. Like, they were just full. And a lot of people, like, it was fun. You know, a godlike creature with five rings and he can do whatever he wants.
let's sit down and try to digest it, right? Mm-hmm. Or dissect it, I should say, see what each ring represents in life. You'll be amazed, right? At how much they're putting in effort. So
yeah, how much money they've put in.
Yeah, so sometimes we need to sit with our kids and explain to them these dangers. And sometimes when kids watch cartoons or movies, like, you got to tell them that, you know, yeah, a movie might have a happy end all the time, but that's not how life is.
Mm.
Life does not always end up in a good way,
yeah,
right? Mm. And there's also another trend that happens. Like, for example, the character, he creates a problem himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the beginning of the movie, he makes something bad, it goes wrong, and then he goes on the process of fixing it, and he becomes a hero. So how about you don't do it in the first place to begin with, right?
Yeah.
So the child says, "Well, I can do something wrong as long as I
can fix it and become a hero later on.
Become a hero later on."
Yeah.
So that kind of mentality needs to be
tackled.
You need to speak to your kids. You need to speak to them and tell them that everything has a limit. You know, fun has a limit. Not everything under the name of fun we can do and we can watch. Like I said, as innocent as Tom and Jerry, read the statistics about it. Mm. It's horrendous. One day I was driving and I was listening to a radio show in Australia. They bring this guy. He's an expert. He's a professor in comics,
mm-hmm.
which is quite, he's a professor at university. And he was saying that all the major stories like Rapunzel, Red Riding Hood, he's like, the essence of them, if you read the actual stories of them, they're horrible stories. And then when he was talking about Red Riding Hood, I can't even say it on the radio, like how the actual story was.
Hmm.
And now we're watching it.
I want to ask you afterwards.
Yeah. So so we don't understand. We actually not doing enough work to see what's going on. So
and analyze.
Yeah. So we need to, when it comes to our children, we need to make sure that they are monitored. We are with them. We explain to them. We let them know what's going on. So they become aware themselves. So inshallah, as they grow older, these things won't take as much effect on them.
And they're going to be responsible, smart, and analyzing human beings themselves and independent, naturally. Well, as much as there is to this topic, we do not have enough time for that. We'll have to end it over here. And thank you for being here with us, brother, and in sharing whatever you shared with us. It was very beneficial, I'm sure, to our viewers also. And please, if you've got questions, topics, comments, anything that you have, send it in at englishradio@irib.ir. And do listen to the previous episodes at pastorday.com. If you feel that it was out of context, everything will fall in place. And until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.